Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to take a look at some things attendant upon Operation Condor. Operation Condor, as discussed in numerous archive shows, including RFA Programs 4, 22, 30, and 37, among other programs, as well as the miscellaneous archive show entitled Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits. Operation Condor was an assassination consortium among a number of Latin American fascist governments, including Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil and Chile. Actually, Brazil may not have been included, but Chile. I believe Brazil was also included. Certainly Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Bolivia. This assassination consortium also involved the cooperation of some elements of U.S. intelligence as well. We're going to take a look at a couple of articles from the very fine IF magazine that were taken off the internet for me by a listener, and research credit on this goes to a different listener in Southern California, for it was she who alerted me to the presence of these two articles in IF magazine. So a tip of the hat to that listener in Southern California, because again, it was she who turned me on to these articles, and also a tip of the hat to the listener who got this for me from the consortium's website. Consortium publishes one of the better magazines that can be found in hardcover. It's called IF Magazine, and you can visit their website at www.consortiumnews.com. That's www.consortiumnews, C-O-N-S-O-R-T-I-U-M-N-E-W-S, one word, .com. And a couple of very fine articles from the January 13th, 1999 issue of IF Magazine are to follow. The first article is about a scientist who was concocting exotic weaponry for this assassination consortium, again, Operation Condor, this assassination consortium involving a number of Latin American fascist governments. There were elements of U.S. intelligence that collaborated with this, as well as some of the residual elements of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground associated with Colonia Dignidad. That's also discussed, by the way, in RFA program number 20. This particular article is entitled Pinochet's Mad Scientist, and it's by Samuel Blixen, B-L-I-X-E-N. It reads as follows. On November 15, 1992, a terrified scientist broke a window of a white bungalow in the Uruguayan beach town of Parque del Plata. Chubby, in his mid-40s, the man struggled through the opening. Once outside, furtively and slowly, he picked his way to the local police station. "I am a Chilean citizen," the scientist told the police when he finally reached the station. He pulled a photostatic copy of his identification papers concealed in his right shoe. Quote, "I have been abducted by the armies of Uruguay and my country," unquote, he claimed. The scientist, rumpled with a graying beard, said he feared for his life. He insisted that his murder had been ordered by General Augusto Pinochet, then the chief of Chile's army, who had ruled as a dictator from 1973 to 1990. The motive for the execution was the man's anticipated testimony at a politically sensitive trial in Chile, a case that could send reverberations all the way to Washington, D.C. The scientist had worked as an accomplice in a terror campaign that included the bombing deaths of Chilean dissident Orlando Letelier and an American co-worker, Ronnie Moffat, as they drove to Washington in 1976. The police in Parque del Plata, a beach town about 30 kilometers from Montevideo, weren't sure what to make of the man's convoluted tale. An Uruguayan army officer had alerted them earlier that an, quote, unbalanced, unquote, Chilean prisoner was on the loose. The scientist, who had escaped from a house owned by an Uruguayan army officer, apparently was that man. But the issue was quickly taken out of the hands of local authorities. Half an hour after the man's arrival, armed and uniformed Uruguayan army troops burst into the police precinct station and seized control. At their head was the district police chief, a retired army colonel named Ramon Rivas. Rivas ordered that the Chilean scientist be turned over to the soldiers. Two Uruguayan army officers were to escort the scientist out of Uruguay to Brazil. Faced with soldiers brandishing rifles, the police relented. The scientist was led away. From that moment, the scientist's fate became a complex kidnap murder mystery with improbable twists and turns, an apparent disinformation trick, raw political power, a grisly discovery, and finally, forensic science. The disappearance of the scientist, a biochemist named Eugenio Berrios, B-E-R-R-I-O-S, has relevance to today's legal battles over Pinochet's possible trial for human rights violations. The Barrios case bears on the international terror campaigns waged by Chile and other South American military dictatorships in the 1970s. The case also underscores the enduring power of right-wing military officers within the fragile democracies of South America and the difficulty of bringing Pinochet to justice in Chile. Though drawing little attention, the Barrios case officially has become part of a larger Pinochet investigation now underway by Spanish Judge Baltasar Garzón. There could be consequences, too, in the United States, where the CIA's prior knowledge about the Letelier assassination at a time when George Bush was CIA director has never been clarified. The mystery of Eugenio Barrios starts in 1974, when he began doing scientific research for Chile's feared intelligence service, the DINA. Barrios worked closely with an American-born DINA agent, Michael Townley, in a clandestine unit known by the name Cuetropia, Q-U-E-T-R-O-P-I-L-L-A. The base of operations was a sprawling, multi-level house, registered to Townley but purchased by DINA in Locuro, C-U-R-R-O, a wooded, middle-class neighborhood of Santiago, Chile. One of Barrios' assignments was the development of sarin gas that could be packaged in spray cans for use in assassinations. DINA officials thought the nerve gas could create lethal symptoms that might be confused with natural causes while giving time for the assailants to escape. The need for sophisticated murder devices grew more important for Pinochet's intelligence teams when they turned their sights on political enemies living abroad in 1975. In September 1975, DINA chief Manuel Contreras launched an international assassination project called Operation Condor, named after the powerful vulture that traverses the Andes Mountains from Colombia to the Strait of Magellan. The theory behind Condor was that enemies of South American military dictatorships should be hunted down wherever they sought refuge, whether in the nations of participating governments or elsewhere. In October 1975, after soliciting $600,000 in special funds from Pinochet, Contreras chaired the organizational meeting of Operation Condor with military intelligence chiefs from Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Brazil. By the way, I was right about Brazil's participation. Bolivia also had a lot to do with Operation Condor. Continuing. After the meeting, the intelligence services stepped up their transnational coordination. More than 100 Chileans were rounded up and returned to Chile for execution. Others were gunned down where they were found. According to later testimony by DINA agent Townley, Barrios made a major contribution to the cause in April 1976 by recreating sarin, a poisonous nerve gas first invented by the Nazis during World War II. The original plan for assassinating Letelier, Townley said, was to use a female operative to seduce the debonair former diplomat and then administer a liquid form of sarin concealed in a Chanel perfume bottle. But Barrios also stocked the operation with explosive devices in case the nerve gas proved unworkable. In September of 76, Townley entered the United States on an official Chilean passport with a false name. He contacted anti-Castro Cubans and recruited their help in hunting down Letelier, a vocal critic of Pinochet. When the Cubans refused to participate unless the Chileans had a direct role in the assassination, Townley switched from poison to a car bomb. The assassins traveled to Washington, where the exiled Letelier lived and worked at a left-of-center think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies. They concealed the bomb under Letelier's car and followed Letelier as he and two American co-workers drove to work on September 21, 1976. As the car proceeded past the ornate buildings of Embassy Row on Massachusetts Avenue, the assassins detonated the bomb. Letelier and one American, Ronnie Moffat, died in the blast. Moffat's husband was wounded. Despite official requests, George Bush's CIA provided little help in unraveling the mystery. Only later would authorities discover that the CIA director's office received a warning about the Townley operation, but failed to stop it. Still, the FBI and federal prosecutors managed to uncover Operation Condor and break the Letelier case. Extradited to the United States, Townley agreed to plead guilty, served a short prison sentence, and entered a federal witness protection program. But progress in bringing to justice the architects of the terror campaign was much slower, given Pinochet's continued hold on power through 1990. Long-term U.S. pressure, however, finally led to criminal charges in Chile against former DINA chief Contreras. Berrios, who continued to work on assassination schemes even after Townley's arrest, emerged as a prospective witness. In October 1991, a Chilean judge called Berrios to testify. The move sent chills through the Chilean military establishment. It became important for DINA to get Berrios beyond the reach of the Chilean court. That month, Captain Carlos Herrera Jimenez, a former intelligence officer, escorted Berrios from Santiago on a clandestine trip through the Andes to Argentina. To hide Berrios, the old Condor network quickly reasserted itself. From Buenos Aires, Uruguayan counterintelligence chief Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Casella coordinated Berrios' move to Uruguay. There, Berrios and Herrera holed up in a Montevideo apartment rented by Casella, who frequently trained with the Chilean military. By the way, Casella, C-A-S-E-L-L-A. Continuing. But complications continued to arise. In February of 1992, while on a trip to Buenos Aires, Herrera was arrested on an Interpol warrant connecting him to another assassination plot. That forced other Chilean agents to take charge of Berrios in Uruguay. Berrios was becoming a burden as well as a risk to Chile's intelligence services. General Emilio Timmerman, a military officer at the Chilean embassy in Montevideo, assumed the Berrios duty. But Timmerman, T-I-M-M-E-R-M-A-N, complained to an embassy cultural attaché, Emilio Rojas, that, quote, "it is costing us too much money," unquote. Timmerman, who is now second in command of the Chilean army, also was growing nervous. Timmerman ordered Rojas to keep his mouth shut about Berrios' whereabouts, the cultural attaché said later. By November 1992, Berrios realized that his Chilean superiors might want him silenced as the safest and cheapest alternative to a long exile. He apparently overheard his captors discussing Pinochet's orders for them to eliminate the scientist. So on November 15, 1992, Berrios climbed through the window of the White Bungalow and fled to the precinct station at Parque del Plata. He begged the police to protect him, but the escape was cut short with the intervention of Uruguayan troops. Berrios disappeared. Exactly what happened next remains a mystery. Senior Uruguayan officials only learned about the November 1992 police confirmation the next June from an anonymous caller. The discovery touched off a political crisis inside the Uruguayan government, where the army still wielded great power. Uruguayan President Luis Alberto Lacalle, or Lacalle, L-A-C-A-L-L-E, was in Great Britain when the story broke. He immediately ducked out of a reception at the Uruguayan embassy in London and flew back to Montevideo. There, Lacalle met with 14 of the 16 generals heading the armed forces. After 4 hours of tough negotiations and threats from 12 generals, Lacalle backed down to avoid a new military challenge to the civilian government. The president relented on his initial inclination to impose severe sanctions against the intelligence services. Lacalle did fire the police chief, Rivas, but agreed only to transfer the head of military intelligence, Mario Agarondo. As for Berrios' fate, Colonel Casella, who supplied an apartment for hiding Berrios, reported that Berrios had gone to Brazil. The colonel assured the government that he had talked to Berrios by phone at the end of November 1992, weeks after his disappearance. There were public doubts that Berrios was still alive, but another assurance about Berrios' well-being surfaced in Europe. The Uruguayan consulate in Milan received an anonymous letter supposedly signed by Berrios and a photo of him holding a recent issue of the Milan newspaper Il Messaggero. By the way, I would note, as we took note of in RFAs 4, 22, 30, and 37, among other programs, Italian and European fascists, primarily Italian and Spanish, participated and coordinated with the various operations of Operation Condor. So it's not too surprising to find a Milanese connection to the Berrios disappearance. Continuing, Lacalle, seeking political peace with Uruguay's military, announced that Berrios is not in Uruguay, he is somewhere else, unquote. That made the Berrios mystery a Chilean matter, unquote, again, the Uruguayan president declared. At the end of the crisis, Uruguay's foreign minister, Sergio Abreu, A-B-R-E-U, met with the Chilean ambassador and bluntly admitted that Lacalle had no choice but to, quote, "let it go," unquote. If Lacalle pursued sanctions against powerful figures in the military, the 12 generals had threatened another military coup, the foreign minister said. Chile's ambassador cabled the news back to Santiago on June 11th, according to a cable that I later obtained. For Uruguay, the Berrios case was closed, or so the authorities thought. The Berrios case resurfaced, quite literally, in April 1995 when two fishermen found a man's decomposed body partially buried at a beach in El Pinar, another resort town about 25 kilometers from Montevideo. The body had broken bones suggesting torture, was wrapped in wire, and had two 45 caliber bullet holes in the back of the neck and head. Forensic doctors used new research techniques to reconstruct the victim's face. The face looked remarkably like Berrios. DNA tests were ordered on the remains with comparisons made against genetic samples from Berrios' relatives. In early 1996, forensic specialists concluded with near certainty that the dead man was Berrios. They placed the date of his death as the first half of March 1993. The findings contradicted the June 1993 photograph, which presumably had been composed using computer graphics to insert a current issue of the Italian newspaper into the photo. But the timing of Berrios' death added yet another side to the mystery. In March 1993, Pinochet had made a personal visit to Uruguay accompanied by 12 bodyguards and with Colonel Casella joining his entourage. In Uruguay, there were suspicions that Pinochet might have used the visit to confront Berrios one more time about his knowledge and then eliminate him. But few observers in either Uruguay or Chile believe that those civilian governments are strong enough today or determined enough to follow the Berrios case and others to clear answers. The best chance for justice probably lies outside the countries that organized Operation Condor. Those nations are still gripped by the vulture's powerful claws. And indeed, I would agree with that last assessment. One of the countries that has been investigating, among other things, Operation Condor, because Spanish citizens had disappeared in that assassination program and in the terror programs pursued by its member governments, in Spain, the investigation has been proceeding, largely because of the efforts of Judge Baltasar Garzón, a name known to veteran listeners to this program as the judge who conducted the abortive investigation or the unsuccessful investigation and prosecution of Monzer El Casar for the Aquile Lauro hijacking. The death of one witness and the inability to get the USDEA to participate, or the evidence of the USDEA and the kidnapping of the family of another witness had much to do with the dismissing of that case. There's a good article about Judge Barazón in that very same issue of IF Magazine, namely January 13th, 1999. This also was pointed out to me by that same listener in Southern California, and researched by and sent to me by yet another listener. The consortium's website, the consortium puts out IF Magazine again, is www.consortiumnews.com. This article by Alvaro Tizón, T-I-Z-O-N, is called The Judge and the Dictator, and it's about Baltasar Garzón, the judge who ordered the extradition of General Pinochet, who headed up the assassination program that employed and appears to have ultimately dispatched Mr. Berrios. Though only 43 years old, Baltasar Garzón, G-A-R-Z-O-N, is widely admired inside Spain as a, quote, super judge, unquote, for his courage pursuing corrupt politicians, drug lords, and arms dealers. Now his fame has gone worldwide with his moves to bring to justice Chile's ex-dictator Augusto Pinochet and other South American tyrants. With his aggressive tactics, Garzón has stepped forward as a kind of international counterpart to the Italian judges who spearheaded investigations into the 1980s into links between Italian politicians and the Sicilian mafia. And I would note that, as we've noted in some of the RFA programs that I've already enumerated in connection with Operation Condor, some of the very same Italian and propaganda Due Lodge-connected Italian fascists that figured in that investigation also actively collaborated with Operation Condor. RFA 20 highlights some of those connections, and that's available from Spitfire. Continuing. Like those investigative judges, Garzón has put his life at risk by venturing beyond the prosecution of common crimes to the murky world where criminals and national security operations intersect. Yet Garzón's case against Pinochet represents a new level of challenge to the international power structure by opening what one former CIA official has called a can of worms, unquote, the history behind two decades of political murders in Latin America. So who is this upstart, quote, super judge, unquote? And after an enumeration of some of his personal background and political career, the article continues, skipping down. The super judge launched other high-profile investigations of alleged terrorism. Garzon targeted Manzar al-Kassar, a Syrian arms dealer who lived part-time in a luxurious Spanish villa. Garzon tried al-Kassar for alleged connections to the Achille Lauro hijacking, but Garzon lost that case. By the way, Garzon, the indictment of Manzar al-Kassar took place just a couple of days after George Bush was defeated for re-election. In RFA 38, I pointed out that George Bush's ambassador to Spain, Mr. Zapala, Joseph Zapala, had previously protected Manzar al-Kassar from prosecution in connection with the Achille Lauro hijacking. Just after George Bush was defeated, the prosecution, unsuccessful, of Manzar al-Kassar for Achille Lauro began. Manzar al-Kassar, a key player in the Iran-Contra affair, as discussed in RFA 32, RFA 35, and the four-part interview with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, co-author of The Secret War Against the Jews. Continuing. Amid his victories and defeats, Garzon's critics derided him as a preening, quote, star, unquote, judge who loved publicity and was prone to judicial overreach. Yet Garzon won admiration from many Spaniards for tackling difficult cases that put his life in jeopardy. He always traveled with bodyguards and often switched meeting places and routes to frustrate possible assassins. Garzon's investigations into the dark underbelly of national security operations led him to his next challenge. In September of 1996, Garzon turned his attention to 320 unsolved murders and disappearances of Spanish citizens during the Dirty War in Argentina from 1976 through 83. In 1997, Garzon demanded the arrests of Argentina's former military dictators for these crimes of state. At the time, the move seemed largely symbolic, but it did put the architects of the Dirty War on notice that they could face arrest while traveling abroad. Garzon proved that he was serious when he arrested former Argentine officer Adolfo Silingo during a trip to Spain. Silingo, S-C-I-L-I-N-G-O, had been the first Argentine officer to admit his participation in mass executions of political dissidents who were shackled together and shoved from planes into the Atlantic Ocean. Garzon argued that these crimes against humanity were similar to those committed by the Nazis in World War II, and that Spain had a right to prosecute the offenders under international law. The judge also sought access to Argentine military bank accounts in Switzerland. According to the law, these crimes must be investigated and hundreds of accusations cannot remain unpunished, unquote, Garzon said in a rare interview in 1998. Quote, we have a moral debt with the relatives of hundreds of victims, unquote. The Audiencia Nacional agreed and formally granted Garzon the power to proceed against human rights abusers living outside Spain. As Garzon's investigations proceeded, they crossed paths with the work of another Spanish judge, Manuel García Castellón, or Castellón, C-A-S-T-E-L-L-O-N. Less flamboyantly, García Castellón was examining the fate of nearly 100 Spaniards who disappeared, unquote, under Pinochet's dictatorship in Chile. García Castellón focused especially on the cross-border assassination schemes known as Operation Condor, named after a high-flying vulture that traverses South America's southern cone. Early in 1998, García Castellón traveled to Washington to ask the FBI for its secret files on Operation Condor. The judge cited a 1990 legal assistance treaty that calls for the exchange of information between U.S. and Spanish law enforcement. At the end of his trip, García Castellón stated that he received, quote, full collaboration from the FBI and the Department of Justice, unquote, but he returned to Spain mostly with information that was already known. The bulk of U.S. evidence came from the case of Orlando Letelier, a former Chilean diplomat who was killed in Washington in 1976 by a car bomb. Yet beyond the FBI data, García Castellón gained little insight into what U.S. intelligence files might hold. The CIA had worked closely with DINA in the mid-1970s, but the CIA has never divulged what it knew about Operation Condor. García Castellón also interviewed Michael Townley, the DINA agent who carried out the Letelier assassination. He pleaded guilty and now is in a U.S. federal witness protection program. The judge met, too, with former DINA chief Manuel Contreras, who was convicted in Chile in 1997 for masterminding the Letelier plot. In that interview, Contreras repeated his claim that his superiors in the Chilean government approved all his actions. Contreras argued that if the idea was to try the real DINA dictator, Chilean courts, unquote, should not have tried me, unquote. Other government documents have established that Pinochet kept tight personal control over DINA. Garcia Castellón concluded that his initial investigation had uncovered enough evidence to justify questioning Pinochet about his responsibility for the human rights crimes, but Pinochet was protected in Chile by an amnesty that he arranged for himself before relinquishing power in 1990. Garcia Castellón saw his chance to force Pinochet's cooperation when the ex-dictator began scouting for a European hospital that could operate on a disc problem in his back. France rebuffed Pinochet's request to be treated there, but Great Britain consented to Pinochet's visa request. The stakes were rising. Garcia Castellón decided that the move to grab Pinochet needed more clout. The case seemed tailor-made for the, quote, superjudge, unquote, Baltazar Garzón. Garcia Castellón persuaded Garzón to take over the case. Garzón, in turn, reached out to British authorities to execute an arrest warrant on Pinochet when he was in London. On October 16th, as the ex-dictator was recovering at a London hospital, Scotland Yard placed him under arrest. In the following weeks, Pinochet's defenders denounced the arrest as unjustified. Former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher praised Pinochet as, quote, a friend of England during the Falklands War in 1982. Conservative columnist Charles Krautheimer howled that Pinochet's arrest was, quote, a blow for the most ideologically selective justice and for the rankest hypocrisy, unquote, an attempt by, quote, the European left to give itself a little consolation prize, unquote. William F. Buckley, another longtime Pinochet enthusiast, denounced the charges as, quote, an act of ideological malice, unquote, against a restrained military leader who ousted, quote, a president, Salvador Allende, who was defiling the Chilean constitution and proudly waving the banner of his friend and idol, Fidel Castro, unquote. However, other European nations, France, Switzerland, Denmark, Belgium, Italy, Germany, Norway, and Luxembourg, sided with Garzón's argument. They weighed in with their own demands for Pinochet's extradition to face other murder charges. Some Europeans saw the Pinochet case as a way to demonstrate rejection of Nazi-like tactics anywhere in the world. Quote, Pinochet is an historic opportunity to show Europe's commitment in the fight for human rights, unquote, said Spanish socialist José Borrell, again quoting, if we give up on Pinochet's arrest, what will happen tomorrow with characters like Milosevic when their cases would be open in the courts? Spain has its own mixed record of standing up to fascists, of course. To ease a transition to democracy in the 1970s, the Spanish government pardoned officials involved in crimes during the rule of fascist General Francisco Franco. Not surprisingly, some former Franco officials objected strongly to Garzón's attempts to extradite Pinochet. Martin Billa, B-I-L-L-A, Franco's minister of government and now a businessman with $2 billion in investments in Chile, saw Garzón's actions as impractical as well as unfair, unquote, or as well as unfair, quote, perhaps the judges can and must act according to the old saying, justice even if the world goes down, unquote, but others can and must do everything to avoid the end of the world, unquote, Bia said. Other Spanish businessmen warned that Argentine-Chilean cases could even backfire. Nevertheless, according to polls in two major Spanish newspapers, El Mundo and El País, some 70 to 80% of the people favor trying Pinochet in Spain for his crimes. There appeared to be a surge in public pride in the integrity of the Spanish judicial system. And it remains to be seen what happens with Pinochet. All of the tapes that I've alluded to are available from Spitfire. Spitfire can be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. Email address spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of the tapes available from Spitfire on www.netcom.com/ALCALAME. That concludes this segment. Thanks for listening.